Wishing you a very wonderful weekend.
This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. The Taliban government claims they didn't know about the top al-Qaeda leader living in their capital. AP correspondent Jennifer King has more.
The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan's Commission for Cultural Affairs had issued a statement condemning Sunday's drone attack on a residential home in Kabul. Today, the Taliban said they are investigating what they described as claims that al-Qaeda chief Ayman al-Zawahiri was killed. In a statement, the group says that it has no knowledge of al-Zawahiri's arrival and residence in Afghanistan. The Taliban had promised in the 2020 Doha agreement that they would not harbor al-Qaeda members or those seeking to attack the U.S., but U.S. officials say the home belonged to Interior Minister Ajuddin Haqqani, the deputy head of the Taliban, who heads the Haqqani Network, an insurgent group that's been fighting in the country since at least the Soviet invasion in 1979. Jennifer King, Washington.
U.S. FBI Director Christopher Wray says he remained worried about the potential for a large-scale attack planned or inspired by al-Qaeda, despite the killing of its top leader in the U.S. drone strike in Afghanistan last weekend. Wray made the comments Thursday during a testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Wray said both al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, as well as their affiliates, intend to carry out or inspire large-scale attacks in the United States. Al-Qaeda chief Ayman al-Zawahiri, a key architect of the attacks of September 11, 2001, was killed during the U.S. strike early Sunday on a safe house in central Kabul. In his first public remarks about al-Zawahiri's killing, Wray said he was not surprised but disappointed that he, the head of the al-Qaeda, was found hiding in a safe house in Afghanistan. For more news, join us, voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. Russian prosecutors are asking a court to sentence basketball star Brittany Griner to nearly a decade in prison on drug charges. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has more on the story.
Griner had told the court she made an honest mistake in having cannabis oil at Moscow's airport.
I never meant to break any laws here.
And she showed little emotion as the judge sentenced her to 9 years in prison.
This is a miscarriage of justice.
U.S. Embassy official Elizabeth Rood says the Biden administration will keep working to free Griner. President Biden calls the outcome unacceptable and urges Russia to immediately release Griner after a politically charged trial, which could lead to a prisoner exchange. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Citing an unnamed official close to the case, the Associated Press is reporting that the former governor of the jurisdiction of Puerto Rico, Wanda Vasquez, has been arrested Thursday on corruption charges. The official, who was not authorized to talk about the case, and the two other unidentified people who were arrested along with the former governor. It marks the first time that a former leader of the Caribbean island and the U.S. territory has faced federal charges. A spokesman for Vasquez offered no comment on the report. In mid-May, Vasquez's attorney told reporters that he and his client were preparing for possible charges against her, but the former governor, that is, at the time, denied any wrongdoing. Amid criticism, he has been slow to adequately respond to the fast-spreading outbreak of the monkeypox virus. A top U.S. health official Thursday declared an emergency response. The emergency declaration comes after a similar announcement was made nearly 2 weeks ago by the World Health Organization. The U.S. states of California, Illinois, and New York had also declared public health emergencies because of the spread of the virus, which causes a painful but rarely fatal disease. Robert Fenton, the National Monkeypox Response Coordinator, said the public health emergency will allow us to explore additional strategies to get vaccines and treatments more quickly out to the impacted areas. As always, for details on more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com. Also, on the VOA mobile app, I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
Today is Friday, August 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Ruofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, China fires multiple missiles around Taiwan in outrage over the visit of U.S. House Speaker.
Its largest ever exercises around the island have now been marked by what the Taiwanese Defense Ministry reports were ballistic missile launches.
Russia's offensive to seize all of eastern Ukraine appears to be suffering setbacks.
The Ukrainian forces continue to control the village of Pisky, which is very close to the city of Donetsk. Reports from that area is that basically the hell is happening there, very heavy battles.
And the U.S. declares monkeypox a public health emergency as more than 6,000 Americans become infected. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. China fired multiple missiles around Taiwan on Thursday as it launched its largest ever military drills in the waters of the island. Beijing is outraged by the visit to Taiwan by U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi, which it regards as its sovereign territory. Matthew Laratondo of Reuters reports.
The ongoing live-fire military drills that China's conducting surrounding Taiwan, its largest ever exercises around the island, have now been marked by what the Taiwanese Defense Ministry reports were ballistic missile launches. Images were broadcast on China's state-run television on Thursday, and on a nearby island frequented by Chinese tourists, captured by a Japanese TV network and shared with Reuters, rocket contrails can be seen flying into the sky. The magnitude of these drills is unprecedented. The last time China launched missiles around Taiwan was back in 1996. All this coming immediately after U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan, which brought outrage from the Chinese government. Taiwanese authorities say the drills are an effective blockade and has responded by scrambling fighter jets and tracking Chinese aircraft it says are slipping into the 12 nautical mile region Taiwan considers its territory. The Chinese government has previously said that it didn't anticipate the drills to cause freedom of navigation issues. It claims Taiwan as its sovereign territory, and on Thursday said its issues with Taiwan were an internal affair. Taiwan's defense ministry has also reported a cyber attack on its website Thursday, and several other government sites were hit earlier in the week. Meanwhile, Speaker Pelosi continues her Asia tour in South Korea on Thursday, where she's expected to visit the demilitarized zone on its border with the North.
That's Matthew Laratondo of Reuters. Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen said on Thursday her country would not provoke conflicts but would firmly defend its sovereignty and national security. President Tsai gave a video message in response to China's exercises. She said, quote, "We will not escalate conflicts or provoke disputes, but we will firmly defend our sovereignty and national security and stick to the line of defense of democracy and freedom," unquote. Taiwan, she continued, quote, "will never be knocked down by challenges," unquote. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also told his Southeast Asian counterparts on Thursday the United States opposes any unilateral efforts to change Taiwan's status quo, especially by force, and its policy on Taiwan has not changed. Blinken is in Cambodia for a security-focused meeting of more than 27 countries expected to discuss the food crisis caused by the Russian-Ukraine war, stability in the Taiwan Strait, and the crisis in Myanmar. China began military drills in the seas surrounding Taiwan on Thursday in retaliation for the visit of U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taipei earlier this week. China claims Taiwan as part of its territory. As Henry Ridgewell reports from Tokyo, where Pelosi and other U.S. lawmakers are due to arrive Friday, allies in the Indo-Pacific region are seeking to bolster alliances with the West and NATO in response to Beijing's action.
5 days of live fire military drills in seven zones surrounding Taiwan began Thursday, broadcast on Chinese state television, the largest such exercises to date carried out by Beijing. China says it is rehearsing for a naval and air blockade. Japan said the exercises overlap territory it claims around islands close to Taiwan. There is nervousness in Japan over the fallout from US Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taipei. Japanese defense forces are taking part in this month's Garuda Shield military exercises in Indonesia for the first time, alongside the United States, Australia, and Singapore, signaling strengthening ties with regional and NATO allies. Meanwhile, Japan, South Korea, and Australia took part in the June NATO summit in Madrid. Analyst Ryo Sahashi.
We have to make a big partnership, not only to hedge against, to push back against Russia, but also to push back against the Chinese ambitions. From that perspective, our partnership with NATO has a really, really big importance for our own Indo-Pacific strategy. And I think it is unstoppable, and this direction will not change.
Japan's foreign minister said Russia's invasion of Ukraine has focused minds on threats in the Indo-Pacific region. That threat is keenly felt across the Asia-Pacific region amid an unprecedented show of force from China in the seas surrounding Taiwan. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Tokyo.
Russia is pressing on with its offensive to seize all of eastern Ukraine's Donbas region, but it appears to be suffering setbacks in Ukraine's south. Reporter Anna Chernikova spoke to Flashpoint Ukraine's Michael Lipping today from the Ukrainian capital and told him what Ukrainian authorities have been saying about their counteroffensive in the Kherson region.
These 53 settlements have already been liberated by the Ukrainian forces. This is official number, and of course, we don't get detailed information in advance or during counteroffensive. We only get it something like 2 weeks later. So it could be considered that might be more, but again, we talk about the confirmed number. Ukrainian forces continue quite successful actions according again to the general staff. We can see that the bridge was almost destroyed. At least the main bridge in the Kherson region, at least it is not functioning at the moment. And also we can hear about certain Ukrainian continuing attacks on the storages of the Russian equipment and so on. What we also can see that Russian forces are moving some of their troops from Donbas area to Kherson and Zaporizhia regions. According to Institute for Study of War, they do this in order to strengthen their directions, their positions there, and they basically are getting ready for the defense. This was also confirmed by the president of Ukraine, Mr. Zelensky. He also reported that Ukrainian army have noticed that Russian forces are moving.
What do we know about the progress of the Russian offensive in the Donbas area?
As I already said, Donbas remains one of the main hotspots. Ukrainian army managed to defend its position, so we do not see any huge advances of the Russian forces. Russian forces have certain successes, but again, according to the international and Ukrainian intelligence, they're not quite huge. So basically, the situation in the area remains more or less similar as it was weeks ago. But this area is under constant missiles attacks. And today, for instance, one of the cities was shelled by the Russian rockets. And unfortunately, civilians were killed and injured. Unfortunately, this is the situation, you know, along the front line in Donbas area. Also here that Ukrainian forces continue to control the village of Pisky, which is very close to the city of Donetsk. But again, reports from that area is that basically the hell is happening there, very heavy battles, and they are continue, and basically Ukrainians continue to defend this territory. But again, we can see very heavy fightings happening there.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine's Michael Lipin. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is to meet his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin in the Russian Black Sea resort of Sochi. A just concluded deal on freeing up Ukrainian grain, along with Russia's backing for a new Turkish offensive against Syrian Kurdish forces, will be on the agenda. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Friday meeting with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin in the Black Sea resort of Sochi will be the second time the two leaders have met in a month. The meeting comes just after the first ship carrying Ukrainian grain left the Black Sea under a Turkey-UN brokered deal between Kyiv and Moscow. Analyst Ilhan Özgel of the Duvar News Portal says Erdogan's success in brokering the UN deal and the Sochi meeting sends a powerful message to Turkey's Western allies about the Turkish leader.
It helps to ameliorate his troublemaker image internationally and regionally. He's still trying to show that he can make deals with Putin, showing to the United States, the Biden administration, that Putin is a close ally and close friend of Erdogan, that he can meet Putin twice a month.
Zal Gazimov, a professor of history at Bonn University and a specialist on Turkish-Russian relations, says with Ankara pursuing a balanced approach to the Ukrainian conflict, the grain deal will further deepen ties between Russia and Turkey.
The current Turkish-Russian relations have definite bonds with the current war in Ukraine. Wheat exports is a new chapter for the region, and Turkey plays a quite significant role as an intermediary and also a close military cooperation between Ukraine and Turkey. And the aspect of Turkey's not joining the anti-Russian sanctions, all that results in dynamics that are of importance both for Moscow and for Ankara.
Turkey-Russian relations are intertwined from North Africa to the Middle East to the Caucasus in a mixture of rivalries and cooperation. The two also have a deepening partnership on energy. Analyst Özgel says Erdogan hopes a Sochi meeting will help resolve an impasse with Putin over Syria. The Turkish leader is looking to launch a major offensive against Syrian Kurdish forces, which Ankara accuses of being linked to an insurgency inside Turkey.
They have already met in Tehran 2 weeks ago. It seems that Erdogan could not get what he wanted from Putin, the permission for a Turkish incursion in northern Syria, where he openly stated the names of two places, Tel Rifat and Manbij. Most likely that he's looking for possibility to make such a military move into northern Syria.
Ankara needs Moscow's cooperation for its military operation, given that Russia controls Syrian airspace. Analyst Gazimov says Putin is wary of Turkey's growing military presence in Syria, but says the two leaders are experienced in managing differences.
Definitely, we see certain inconveniences on the both sides, but also the very huge readiness to discuss it with each other.
That readiness to talk and the growing list of common interests across the region means the frequent visits between the two leaders may become a regular thing. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
The federal government on Thursday announced the rapid spread of the monkeypox virus in the United States is a public health emergency. That announcement will reduce bureaucrats' hurdles to speed up deployment of vaccines and treatments. The details from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
The official declaration of monkeypox as a nationwide health emergency was made by U.S. Health Secretary Javier Becerra in a conference call with reporters.
We're prepared to take our response to the next level in addressing this virus, and we urge every American to take monkeypox seriously and to take responsibility to help us tackle this virus.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre asked about criticism that the federal government responded too slowly to monkeypox, especially in ordering vaccines, acknowledged it was not seen as a big threat when the virus emerged here back in the month of May.
It's spreading much more rapidly. It's the dynamic of it has changed. That tends to happen inherently with viruses.
Most of the current cases in the United States, the total approaching 7,000, are spread among men having sex with men. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
In other news, the White House has urged Russia on Thursday to accept, quote, the substantial, unquote, offer made for the release of basketball star Brittney Griner, convicted of drug charges. Both White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre and National Security Spokesperson John Kirby said Griner should never have faced the trial where she was found guilty of bringing cannabis-infused vape cartridges into Russia. Jean-Pierre said the offer was also made for U.S. citizen and former Marine Paul Whelan. Griner, a two-time Olympic gold medalist and a Women's National Basketball Association star, was arrested in mid-February as she arrived to play for a Russian side during the WNBA offseason. Her sentencing could now pave way for a U.S.-Russian prison swap that would include a 31-year-old athlete and an imprisoned Russian who was once a prolific arms dealer. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Remember to connect with us on social media.
We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. New data shows life expectancy in Africa rose by nearly 10 years between 2000 and 2019, though disruptions to health services due to COVID-19 threatened to roll back the gains. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
There's a lot of good news in the World Health Organization's State of Health in Africa report released Thursday. Most notable is the increase in life expectancy from 46 years in 2000 to 56 years in 2019. However, WHO officials note that is still well below the global average of 64 years. WHO Assistant Regional Director for Africa, Lindiwe Makubalo, warns the life expectancy gains could easily be lost unless countries strengthen and make greater investments in the development of healthcare systems. Speaking from the Republic of Congo's capital, Brazzaville, she says Africa has made a good start in that direction over the past two decades. She notes, on average, access to essential services like basic primary health care improved to 46% in 2019, compared with 24% in 2000.
Other factors include improvements in reproductive, maternal, newborn, and child health. Additionally, the rapid scale-up of health services to tackle infectious diseases such as HIV and TB, as well as malaria, over the past 15 years has been a strong catalyst for improved health life expectancy.
While progress has been made in preventing and treating infectious diseases, the report finds health services for non-communicable diseases are lagging far behind. It says the dramatic rise in hypertension, diabetes, cancer, and other non-communicable diseases could jeopardize health gains if those conditions continue to be neglected. The report says the COVID-19 pandemic has unleashed greater disruptions to essential health services on the African continent compared to other regions of the world. Makubalo says they might affect healthy life expectancy estimates.
As governments work to restore affected health services, it is crucial not only to aim to re-establish health systems to pre-pandemic levels, rather it is important that significant improvements are made and they are needed to ensure quality, equitable, and accessible services.
The report notes some progress has been made in achieving universal health coverage, but far from enough. Health officials say one of the key measures to improve access to health services is for governments to increase their public health budgets. That, they say, would reduce the catastrophic out-of-pocket expenditures by households that are pushing millions of people into poverty. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
NASA discusses its upcoming test flight to the moon, plus another look into the history of our universe, and we'll remember a beloved fictional pioneer in space flight. VOA's Arash Rabasadi brings us The Week in Space.
One fire.
An update from last week when we reported on a successful full-scale hot fire test of a Space Launch System, or SLS, rocket booster in the Utah desert. NASA and aerospace company Northrop Grumman oversaw the effort, and data collected will help engineers better design future boosters to launch astronauts to the moon and beyond. This week, NASA discussed the future of its Artemis program, which looks to put humans back on the lunar surface for the first time in half a century.
It's a future where NASA will land the first woman and the first person of color on the moon. And on these increasingly complex missions, astronauts will live and work in deep space and will develop the science and technology to send the first humans to Mars.
Artemis 1 is to be NASA's first flight of its massive SLS vehicle, which carries the Orion spacecraft on top. After countless delays and setbacks, the agency eyes a launch date no earlier than August 29th for an uncrewed mission that will circle the moon before returning home to Earth. Also, this week in history, President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed the National Aeronautics and Space Act of 1958, establishing the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA.
Sulu.
But also this week, sad news about a space pioneer who only set foot on a make-believe spaceship. Nichelle Nichols, more commonly known as Lieutenant Uhura from the 1960s TV show Star Trek, died.
Step into my parlor, gentlemen.
Nichols is remembered for her groundbreaking role as a black space officer and what's widely considered the first interracial kiss on American television between her and fellow cast member William Shatner, who played Captain James T. Kirk. In a social media post, Shatner praised her work advancing social issues in the U.S. and throughout the world. Nichols was 89. We leave you this week with a new image from NASA's James Webb Space Telescope. The Cartwheel Galaxy formed following a high-speed collision that happened some 400 million years ago. The rings you see are shockwaves from that interstellar crash, and what form they ultimately take remains a mystery. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Hi, this is Larry London, and Border Crossings is with you every day, playing requests and dedications starting at 1500 Universal. And throughout the month of August, I'm giving away the new Now 83 CD, which features Kendrick Lamar, Dove Cameron, Tyga, Imagine Dragons, Shawn Mendes, Diplo, and the list goes on and on. The Weeknd, Camila Cabello, Doja Cat. It's all on Border Crossings at 1500 Universal. Listen to Win right here on The Voice of America.
And to all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com, from voanews.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com, and thanks for listening. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I'm Chinua from Washington. Have a great weekend.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to responsibly managing its relationship with the People's Republic of China by leading with diplomacy and keeping open channels of communication. To further this goal, Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with his counterpart, PRC State Councilor Wang Yi, for 5 hours on the sidelines of the recent G20 conference in Bali. After the meeting, Secretary Blinken told reporters the two talked about regional and global issues in which both countries had stakes, including the Kremlin's unprovoked war against Ukraine and North Korea's nuclear program. They also discussed areas where more cooperation between the PRC and the United States should be possible: the climate crisis, food security, global health, and counter-narcotics. The two leaders discussed areas of disagreement as well, said Secretary Blinken, including Beijing's increasingly provocative rhetoric and activity toward Taiwan, the PRC's repression of freedom in Hong Kong, forced labor, the treatment of ethnic and religious minorities in Tibet, and genocide in Xinjiang. Secretary Blinken also said he shared with State Councilor Wang the United States' concern over the PRC's alignment with Russia, despite the Kremlin's brutal war of choice against Ukraine. "What you hear from Beijing is that it claims to be neutral," he declared. "It's pretty hard to be neutral when it comes to this aggression. There is a clear aggressor. There is a clear victim. There is a clear challenge not only to the lives and livelihoods of people in Ukraine, but there is a challenge to the international order that China and the United States as permanent members of the Security Council are supposed to uphold." Secretary Blinken noted that in any case, the PRC's actions belie its claim to neutrality. Beijing and Moscow announced their no-limits partnership as Russia was amassing troops on Ukraine's border. In June, President Xi reaffirmed that he stands by that decision. In addition, Beijing continues to support Russia at the United Nations and other international organizations, and Beijing echoes and amplifies Russian propaganda around the world. Secretary Blinken categorized the meeting with State Councilor Wang as useful and constructive. He warned, however, this really is the moment where all have to stand up, as we heard country after country do in the G20, to condemn the Russian aggression.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.